All right, my name is Chris Bell. This is the second interview with Colonel F.M. Pope. Last day we talked about Colonel Pope's early life, his education, his time in the militia in London, his coming to Canada, working for the CPR, education at McGill, joining up the Seaforth Highlanders in 1939, coming to Britain in 1939-40, training, rising through the ranks, and we ended off with Colonel Pope then as intelligence sergeant, which was the intelligence officer, I suppose, for the Seaforth. And I guess that would leave us to what
it was intelligence sergeant, but as there was no intelligence officer at the time,
you did the duties.
Commanding officer had a direct link with me, or I had a direct link with him, put it the other way around. And he used to occasionally ask my advice.
And this was Swivel-Eyed...
Swivel-Eyed Steve. Wonderful, wonderful fellow.
How far could you possibly go? What sort of latitude would he give you?
Well, he'd ask me questions about an area that we might be moving into for an exercise. He might ask me to lead a company commander with his company in their vehicles to a certain rendezvous point, and he'd just give me the map reference, and I was up to me to get them there by the shortest route. And apart from that, I had to keep a record, as I said before, of all the enemy bombs that landed from air raids, or any sabotage action, if any, that may occur in our assigned area.
Okay, pertaining to that now, did you run across any unexploded bombs that you had to deal with?
Well, the unexploded bombs were looked after mainly by the Home Guard. And they had a horrible habit of not telling you where they were until they put up a sign to say they were UXB. But you weren't quite sure just where it was, perhaps, but except there was one in the area. And occasionally the Home Guard would string a wire or a rope across a road, a country road, not tell anybody about it. And I remember one time I was going down, and this was to cordon off an area where there was a UXB. And I was going down this country road at night, minding my own business, as they say, on my motorbike. And I was wearing my Glengarry hat. And I was doing a modest 30 miles an hour on my Norton motorbike. And I suddenly sensed there was something, I didn't know what, across the road. And I ducked my head down to the handlebars, and my Glengarry was taken right clean off by a wire. If I'd been riding sitting up straight, which I normally did, I could have had my throat cut without any trouble at all.
Yes, I've heard stories of that happening. It decapitates you.
And I was very careful when I was going down country roads, because this was a very much of a side country road, dirt road.
And this was at night, wasn't it?
This was at night, no lights. And it was a bit of a surprise. I found it was they had cordoned off an area. And I suppose they thought nobody would ever come down that road.
Well, didn't they specify or specifically mark where the bomb was, just in the general area?
Yes, but in the country I found that they had a habit of saying there's a UXB in that field. Now, the field might be 200 yards wide by 400 yards long. And somewhere in that area there was a UXB. They may not have known themselves just where it was. All they knew was there was there, one fell there, because they heard it fall, but it hadn't exploded. So they said, UXB. And then it was up to the bomb disposal boys to find it after that.
What about sabotage? Did you run into any?
I didn't run into any sabotage at all.
No fifth column?
Outside of that fifth column, this was the light that I described in the previous.
Were there many examples of that in Britain at the time?
Oh, there were a lot in South England, Southern England particularly, between London and the Channel Coast. Sussex.
Okay, now what year and what month were you promoted to the intelligence sergeant?
I vaguely remember it was about the month of August 1940.
Okay, August 40, Dunkirk is gone. Any thoughts of that period?
No particular thoughts, I would say, at that time, except I was trying to concentrate on becoming a reasonably good soldier. And I was keeping in touch with things, but it was more or less, we were being more or less trained against the possibility, and at one moment appeared to be inevitability, of a German landing on the shores of Kent or Sussex or Essex. And as we were the only division-sized unit that was fully armed and organized,
had the mobility as well.
And had the mobility, we were the only ones that really and truly between the coast and London. And,
I suppose that your designated rank gave you quite a bit more freedom than the ordinary soldier. In this
oh, I had so much freedom, it was, you might say, unreal. Because with my little motorbike, I might be sent by, for instance, after one exercise down in Kent, the commanding officer found that the Seafalls had been blamed for the killing of a number of chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a loud complaint from the farmer concerned. And I was sent down to investigate. Well, I had about a 40-mile motorbike trip one way to find out what hedgerow the chickens had been eaten. And all I found, of course, were feathers. Where the chickens came from could have been any one of several farms in an area of half a mile.
Mm-hmm.
And all I could possibly identify as far as the commanding officer was concerned was that if the chickens had in fact been taken, and the evidence appeared to be that some had been taken because of the feathers,
mm-hmm.
That company so-and-so must have done it, because they were the ones who were occupying that hedgerow at the last known time we were in that area in the exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was one, this reminds me of one escapade which took place when we were in the fields near Oxted,
mm-hmm.
in Surrey. There was a private estate there, quite a few acres, with a wire fence, spike fence, all the way around the grounds. And they had prize Hereford cattle. Somehow or other, some Seafalls, who apparently were wanting some good steaks, managed to kill one of the steers to get it over the fence without leaving a scratch mark on the fence and not leaving very many drag marks,
mm-hmm.
and got it away and butchered it and cut it up into steaks and roasts. And the only thing we could find as a way of evidence of any kind was that one of the companies on the Seafall ate extremely well for about a week. We never found out how they did it.
How high was the fence?
The fence was about 6 feet high.
And that cow, the steer must have weighed quite a few pounds.
Oh, it was not a young steer, it was a full-grown steer.
Uh-huh.
And somehow or other, they got it.
Uh-huh.
There were some wheel marks on the estate side of the fence,
uh-huh.
but not on the highway side of the fence. And how they got it over that fence without any fur from the animal or anything sticking on any part of that fence with a spiked metal fence, steel fence.
Resourceful, aren't they?
Resourceful. They obviously came from northern BC, I think.
Undoubtedly.
Rocky Mountain Rangers.
Well, speaking of food, tell me about the rations you were served.
The rations were excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in the sense that I, of course, have always been able to eat anything. And as a sergeant, I went through the feed line, chow line, the last of my intelligence section. And I ate extremely well, because some of them were a little bit finicky.
Yeah.
And what they didn't eat, I did.
Mm-hmm.
So I ate extremely well.
Well, what did it consist of?
Well, you get the usual army sort of rations, bangers and mash.
Yeah.
And, you get a kind of porridge for breakfast, sometimes some dry cereal.
Any bacon or eggs? Is that wishful thinking?
Bacon, we got bacon.
Mm-hmm.
And we got eggs. We weren't rationed like the civilian population.
Mm-hmm.
We ate extremely well. In fact, when we were living in the fields of Kent near Edenbridge, and the Germans were bombing London, really and truly, we were so comfortable, we were almost ashamed of ourselves. And a large number of the men, when they had a 48-hour leave or anything like that, they took the train from Edenbridge into London and purposely went into the areas like the East End of London to give all the help they could during the bombing. And then, having spent their 48 hours, come back again, because we felt, you know, we were so sheltered out there, we were feeding so well, and the men used to take food in with them to give to families who befriended them and so forth.
I suppose your mother was still in Bedford, so you probably did likewise.
Well, my mother was in Bedford, and she was living with my grandmother, and Bedford was one of these safe towns, so-called. I think the nearest a bomb landed there throughout the whole war was about a mile and a half away from the town.
There was no industry at all in Bedford?
No, but there was a vital station named Croydon, just outside, which was a blimp station where they made the blimps that they stuck up all around London and Manchester. And
the barrage balloons.
Yeah, the barrage balloons. And that's where, it was at Coddington way back in the 30s, I remember, the R-33. And I went up the mooring tower where the R-33 was moored. I saw then how they were making the gas bags for the R-33, and that is another story altogether. It's just fabulous.
What? What did you tell me?
Oh, well, they received wooden casks of what they call go-beater skins, which are taken from the intestines of beef, and they came mainly from the Argentine, and they were packed in salt, and they took these go-beater skins, which, when they took them out of the cast, I guess they were about 10 inches long by about 5 inches wide, maybe a bit less. And they took each one and put it onto a very fine, I've forgotten what the fabric was, but very, very fine. You could see right through it. And they put each skin first horizontally, then vertically, crisscrossing each other, until they covered the whole area of the room. Then they let the room go up and did another strip. And all these skins grow into each other so that they become eventually one big skin, which they then make into the gas bag or to hold the necessary gas for the Zeppelin, for the airship, or
dirigible.
And it was just a fabulous. And that was all done at Croydon. And Croydon, strange to say, is not very far from a town called Bletchley.
Bletchley Park,
of which people know because of, what's the name of the fellow?
Intrepid.
Yeah. That's right.
That's another whole ball of wax, as
that
we say.
Certainly is.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, that's a sideline.
It is, yeah. We should actually get back on the track of your military career, because we're wasting the tape, we're using the tape for.
We were looking at the intelligence sergeant, weren't we?
Yeah, and your duties, I think.
And my duties were very flexible. If I had a feeling that something needed looking into with regard to some information from the Home Guard, which could be related to fifth columnists or anything like that, I'd just leave a message for the commanding officer and take off.
But what were your relations with the Home Guard?
Relationships are very good. They were most of them the senior officers, mostly World War I people. And they took a far harder look at their duties and what they should do and regarding fifth columnists and so forth than we visitors to England.
Well, what about the image of the dad's army, the old boys who go down to the town hall every evening?
Well,
was it like that, or was it?
There were certainly in every village. There was a meeting at the local pub. That was the obvious place for the boys to meet. Because war or no war, a pint of bitter helps to make the plans. And that was the normal way. It was either that they either met at the pub or they met at the manse where the local gent had his family and so forth. Mm. But you had people who were bank managers and bakers and butchers and so forth, and when you think that they were doing their normal jobs in the daytime, and many of them were spending most of their night up, they were contributing in no small way. because if the Germans had landed, they would have to play an extremely big part. And they consequently who had all kinds of booby traps, the Germans would have had a hell of a time. Mm-hmm. They would really, because these people, though they were not all equipped with Lee-Enfield rifles, they had shotguns, duck guns, and down in Kent, in the Romney Marsh area, the local people there figured they could get a lot of Germans down into the marshes and get them lost and never get out of there.
I didn't have to ask.
Or the marshes,
you can sink
and nobody knows you've gone. Mm. And they figured they'd have a gay old time.
Oh, yeah. All right, now it's the summer of 1940. How long were you the intelligence sergeant?
I was the intelligence sergeant, if I remember correctly, until about December 1940, when I was selected to go on OCTU. And I had to appear, well, first of all, I was recommended by my commanding officer, Colonel Stevenson, dear old Civil Eye. And then I went up before the brigade commander, who at that time was Brigadier Potts.
Perks, it was no longer.
Potts, and Perks was commanding 1st Div. I think he just took over. And then I appeared before Perks. And he was a bit abrupt, which was a habit of his. And if he ever smiled at you, look out. If Perks ever smiles at you when he's in a military uniform, look out, because you're in for trouble.
Did he smile at you?
However, he didn't smile.
That's good.
And he asked me, why do you want to be an officer? And I said, well, sir, I'm not sure that I do. And he looked up and he said, well, what military experience have you got? And I said, very little, sir. I was with the London Scottish before I immigrated to Canada. Mm-hmm. And he said, London Scottish? How long? I said, well, I was only there for about a year and a bit before I emigrated. He said, London Scottish. Who is your company sergeant major? I said, I think his name was Davidson, sir, and he was a deputy director of Shell in the UK. He said, well, he said, in that case, he said, I'll pass you immediately. Because he said, my experience of the London Scottish is they had officer material all through the ranks. Mm-hmm. So I went on to OCTU at Camp Borden, England, along with about 120 others. Mm-hmm. And
these were all 120. They were all NCOs from other Canadian
regiments. Right, Provo and 48th Highlanders and whole number of regiments. Mm-hmm. Patricias, Seaforths, Loyal Eddies. Loyal Eddies didn't have any of your body in my course. And
the course, where was this held?
Camp Borden, England.
Camp Borden, yeah. They've got one too, didn't they?
Oh, yes. In fact, our Camp Borden was named after theirs. Mm-hmm. I think. I'm not sure of that. I think Camp Borden in England was named in World War I.
Awesome. And I think Camp Borden in Canada was named in World War I.
Yeah, I think they
were
both.
We had a prime minister, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Borden and Hurley.
And I was still pondering whether to become an officer. Mm-hmm. That it wouldn't be perhaps better to fail and go back to the unit and be somebody of importance. But I stuck with it, and I was commissioned. And fortunately, the battalion was apparently short of officers. And I returned right away from OCTU with my shiny two pips up and reported in to my commanding officer, Colonel Stevenson. And he said, I'm assigning you to Baker Company. You report there immediately. I said, yes, sir. So I reported to the company commander of Baker Company. We at that time were in a place called Limpsfield in Surrey. And
who was the company commander of the company?
Bert Hoffmeister.
We'll talk about him a little bit later.
And he called me in and he said, well, thank God you've arrived. He said, I've kept a platoon just for you. Mm-hmm. He said, it's the worst damn platoon in the battalion. And if you don't have it whipped into shape in 30 days, he said, I'll fire you. You can go back to the reserve depot. Mm-hmm. Well, that was a big enough threat to make anybody. make a success out of something.
Was it, in fact, the worst company, or worst platoon?
Well, I'd known them all when I was in the ranks. And, of course, they greeted me like a long-lost brother, and I had to establish pretty rapidly that I was no longer a rear rank blank file. I was now a shiny two-pip wonder. And fortunately, I had an old friend who was the platoon sergeant. And between us, we had that platoon going like a fireball in next to no time. All they needed was somebody who they knew never said, if you don't do so-and-so, I'll get you for it. And then knowing very well that officer would never get them for it, whether they knew very well if I ever said that I would get them. And I told the whole lot. I said, any one of you give me any trouble, I said, it's going to have to be trouble worth it. I said, I'll get you not less than 30 days in detention. And I said, if I can't get you 30 days, I'll deal with you myself here. But if you give me any real trouble, it's a minimum of 30 days. Or 30 days in the glass house would keep any fellow going fairly straight. So we got along extremely well, and on the first long route march, which we were put on shortly after I took over,
and when was that approximately?
That was in the spring of 1941. It was a 30-mile route march to be completed in one day with fighting pack, rifle, anti-tank boys rifle, and everything else that had to go. And I promised my platoon that if they all finished, with emphasis on the all, there would be at least one keg of beer, full of beer, for the whole platoon. In fact, if they did really well, I might even spring two kegs of beer ready for them. And the sons of guns made damn sure that I paid, because they helped each other, they carried each other, and every one of them made the 30 miles, the only platoon in the whole company that did. And they all made it, and they all got two kegs. They got two kegs of beer. It was worth every drip.
I imagine it was.
It was, but they appreciated it, because they had had that kind of thing said by previous platoon commanders, and nothing happened. Sort of said, well, I made it, but I didn't think any of you would finish, you know, and therefore they get the figure they can get out of it.
Yeah.
But from then on, I used to challenge them at rifle shooting. I used to say, anybody thinks they can outshoot me? All right, let's go down into that field and we'll see if you can.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, I was a reasonably good shot. And the fellow would have to be really good to beat me.
Mm-hmm. Or did you have any disciplinary problems at all in your prison?
Not me.
Yeah.
Not me.
Automatic understanding.
Well, the thing is, they knew darn well I'd never asked them to do anything that I couldn't do as well, if not better than they could.
Mm-hmm. And they respected you for that.
That's right. No, I had no problem. In fact, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
What I didn't like was when I was moved from that position of platoon commander to be the intelligence officer
of
the Sea Force.
And when did that take place?
And that took place when, just before we moved to Hurstpier Point,
mm-hmm.
a place where the officers were housed in a delightful house called Danny House. And it was in the living room of Danny House in 1918 that the British War Cabinet met to decide on the terms of the armistice. And to prove it, there is a panel in the living room which you can slide back, and there are the names of all the Prime Minister and all the Cabinet. And a guy called Churchill was on that list. And it was in that room that we used to hold our after dinner, have our after dinner coffee and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We lived the life of Riley. It was just terrific.
This was in what? In summer of 1941?
This was in the fall of 1941.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me, by that time, had the Sea Force in 1940, they were really on the coast, defending the coast. Had their role changed significantly at that point?
We were still there defending and training, starting with platoon training, company training, battalion training, brigade training, division training,
and combined
and all the level exercises. We didn't do any combined operations in 1941.
You were to do that in the next year, weren't you?
That started in 1942.
So we're in the fall of 41, and you're the intelligence officer. Were your duties any different than they were when you were an intelligence sergeant?
I got back my old motorbike. And again, because of that particular position, I had a fairly free operation. But we were getting into, a fellow named Montgomery had taken over command of Corps headquarters under which we came in southern England. And he was the one who started this, what do they call it? I've forgotten now. We were using live ammunition, battalion exercise.
Battle drill.
And I and my I section were the enemy.
Really?
And all my fellows were equipped with blanks, mm-hmm. but I was allowed to have live ammo.
What was the reason for that? Just so that the people who were doing the attacking...
The company that was doing the attacking on the enemy...
Wouldn't be sure.
Would hear bang-bang from the blank ammo. Okay. But if they stood up mm-hmm. on a skyline to hold a little company O group, mm-hmm. they're liable to find the tree above them and suddenly gets hit with a bullet. And at a distance of about 200 yards, they never knew when a live bullet might smash into the tree above them.
Sure.
And that used to make them duck. That was the right idea, and I was the only one allowed to do that.
Did you ever have any mishaps at all?
I never had any mishaps. I never missed a guy in my life. I mean, I always hit the tree.
Yes, if you never missed a fellow, it would be a little bit messy.
I never hit one.
Yeah. Did you find that the battle drill was...
Oh yes,
exercise.
It got everybody out of the old trench thinking or anything like that. Mind you, we got out of that already, because on all our exercises we were being moved by vehicles, and then debussing and spreading out and moving into whatever the exercises were, and these company exercises, they did help develop stamina, because the exercises were done over a distance of about 4 or 5 miles,
mm-hmm.
where they had to deploy, they had to move fast. The defenders, we used to stick it until we felt that they were getting too close.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would withdraw to the next advantage point for defense. And all this had to be worked out over the ground before any of this exercise took place. And one officer, one of the company commanders, I've forgotten, I think it was Jimmy Creighton, who organized everything. And I, as the commander of the defense, with my I section, I had to know what their timing was and everything. But we had to be in situ, of course, before they arrived in the area. The company didn't know where they were going, because different areas were chosen. So you couldn't say, I've been over that course before, I know exactly where things are going to happen. But we were beginning to develop a knowledge of exercises, that when we got into the bigger exercises where they had umpires,
mm-hmm.
that we got to know the right answers to give to any questions the umpires might have.
Did you feel at all with the repetition of the exercises that it was dulling you at all? Because in the fall of 41, you've been there for almost 2 years now, and surely if morale was not sinking, at least the feeling was that you're getting stale.
There were some of the fellows who were getting really fed up. In fact, a few of them went AWL and disappeared over to Ireland. And from there back to the States, and then up there through to Canada. Of course, they were AWL. They were liable to be picked up if they ever crossed the Canadian border. But quite a few, I'd say about 10 that I know of, personally, went that way. Generally, they were men who had just married before they left. They wanted to get back. Things weren't happening. It was boring. They felt that they'd been sold down the river,
mm-hmm.
and they decided to do something about it. Other fellows said, well, if I'm not getting back to Canada, might as well make a home here. And the majority did that.
Mm-hmm.
But it became a matter of, well, here goes another exercise. And where do we go this time? Do we go into Kent, or do we go into West Sussex, or where are we going? And They did try and change the areas around. One time, I wasn't on the exercise, but the battalion, the brigade, and 1st Division, actually, went right up through London in vehicles to take part in a theoretical landing by German airborne troops in Essex. And they were rushed up through London with the police clearing the traffic and non-stop right through. And I hear it was quite a show, but the only trouble was they got out of their vehicles at night time somewhere in Essex, and most of the men and the company commanders didn't know where the hell they were. Mm-hmm. So things got a little bit mixed up there, but it's only by getting into mix-ups like that you start to realize what should have been done, mm-hmm. and so you gain experience from the exercise.
I've heard that argument before, and usually applied to something like DF, and I do question it myself, that if it's really necessary, that sort of exercise.
I can assure you that every bit of exercise that we participated in before we landed in Sicily made us professionals. It would be rather like throwing you in to play football with the BC Lions and say, well, you've played at university, you don't need much training, you've already got the basics, and put you in and say, go to it, and you get murdered on the first play. Well, the only reason is because you weren't trained enough. You thought you were trained, but you weren't. And it's the same with army. If you don't continually train, so that it becomes automatic without having to think, that's the only chance you have of having a safe life.
Well, isn't there a limit to the training that you can do?
Do you really mean there's a limit?
Well, it does dull the senses after a while if you do repetition.
Not if you keep the thing changing a bit.
Yeah,
the scenery changing, the method in which the exercise is being run change. So that things are a little different. Instead of being allowed to march, you've got to run. And then when you get used to running, you bring back to marching. Golly, that's duck soup now. You see, whereas before marching was considered enough, and then they started you running, you started to complain and grouse. But you've got your muscles in shape, you've got your stomach in shape, and every bit of training just helped. And when it comes to deployment of a section, fast, quickly, we train our people to be independent, to rely on themselves. Whereas if you look at any United States Army training, it's all stick together, rely on each other. Well, we say rely on each other, but rely on yourself too.
Okay.
And you cannot do with too much training.
I guess we've proven that point.
Can't. I'm convinced of it. Sure, you will go through a period where, in the unreal, the not real, no live ammo, etc., things are boring because you know all the answers. You've been through similar type exercises. Sure, they've changed things a bit, but heck, you're smart enough, you know the answer to that. And so you tend to relax, except that you still have got a sense of belonging to a unit, and your unit is better than other units. So even though you may be a bit bored, they're going to make damn sure that your unit is still going to keep up, if not do better than the others.
Yes, I suppose pride in units are very important.
Oh, that's why doing away with the regimental system in the Army would be absolutely disastrous.
Kill morale completely.
Absolutely.
What about inter-regimental sporting events or games of any sort?
Well,
did you keep mostly
the first winter, the Seaforths, naturally we had some rugger. We played some rugger with local English teams. And we did enter a team in the, what they call the Richmond Seven-a-Side. And we had a pretty darn good team.
Did you play the team?
No, I didn't. I was getting a little long in the tooth for rugger. I was about 30... When was this, 40? Yeah, I was about 31. And there were some much faster, younger fellows. But our team did extremely well. We got into the finals. And that represents, you know, all the London club teams and everybody. So we did pretty well.
What about hockey or cricket or other sports?
Hockey, I don't remember any. Cricket, we played the odd game of cricket in the summertime with local village and so forth, but not much of it.
Was there much interaction?
Because they were In the south of England, most of the cricket pitches or the fields that they used in which they played cricket, they erected these high spikes of mast to discourage
gliders,
airborne landings, and low-flying aircraft, too low-flying, etc., so that you stop playing cricket. And they used to play some soccer. But generally speaking, most of that just disappeared. We were too busy on exercises.
Was there much interaction?
Dances, yes. There were dances. And fellows would come back from a four-day exercise, which they hadn't stopped. And that very night, they'd brush up, clean up, and then march 12 miles themselves, without anybody telling them to do it, to go to a dance and walk 12 miles back.
All the pretty girls, though.
Sure.
Yeah.
It makes all the difference. But they did it on their own.
Uh-huh.
They weren't told to do it. That makes a big difference.
It does, man. Well, how were your relations with the people?
Terrific.
Yeah.
Just terrific.
And I suppose little...
You'd get into fights in the bars sometimes. Uh-huh. But we got along extremely well. What did disrupt things later on, just before we left for Sicily, were the American soldiers who landed, who had great big wads of money and felt they could buy anybody.
Yeah.
And they would roll into a pub and say, "Drinks on us." And the local people wouldn't take it.
Why not? Just offended by the fact that...
Yeah. You know, get to know us. Sure, we'll take a drink. But don't just walk in and say, "Drinks on us." They say, "Who are you?"
Yeah.
"I'm an American soldier, etc. I've got the money. What's wrong?"
Mm-hmm.
"I'll pay for you. To hell with you." And that's when we used to get in fights with the Americans.
And that happened often?
Quite often. Yeah. Particularly up in Scotland, around Aberdeen. I heard stories. But I never got there myself. But I heard stories about some of the Yanks that were up there, and the Scots people didn't like them, because they were, "You know, we've got lots of food, have some." They said, "Forget it, we're on ration. We don't want any more than our next door neighbor." And the Americans couldn't understand it. "What's wrong? Don't you want a ham? Nice 15-pound ham? Here you are." "See, 15-pound ham? How'd you get that? If you're over here, you should be on ration like the rest of us."
And they paid more, they had more to eat.
More money, more food, more everything.
They took it for granted.
Yeah, and couldn't understand why the British wouldn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
They said, "Well, why? We can't take it because we can't pay you back."
Yeah.
And that was... the Americans learned, but this is what happened when they first landed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, tell me something that's perhaps a bit off the track, but do you have any leave in London?
Yes, I had leave in London. Not very often, because I used to generally go back to Bedford to see my mum. I went down to Bournemouth one time, and that was lovely. Day almost like this, about 20 degrees Celsius. And, you know, when you've got your kilt on, your gangari on, and you walk along the waterfront at Bournemouth.
Tell me something.
It feels pretty good.
This is really off the track, but do you wear anything under your kilt? Or is that still...
You damn right you do, unless you want to get chap legs. You're darn right. You'd be crazy not to.
Okay.
Now, maybe some of the boys, if they're going out on the night, may forego it, but to do without them, you will rue it. You will develop a widespread warp because of chap legs in the middle, in the thighs, inside thighs.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask about. What about London itself? You did spend time there.
I spent one night in London, to be absolutely honest.
That's all?
No, two nights. One night I went down to the East End, and that was just on a 48-hour pass.
That's the poor district of London.
That's the dockyards, dockside, and that's where the Germans were bombing a lot, because that's where our supplies came in, food came in. They wanted to wreck the docks. But one night I did spend near Trafalgar Square, and there's a Lion's Corner House at the corner of Charing Cross Road and Trafalgar Square, and the basement room was kept open all night, 24 hours. Where you could get coffee, sandwich, bangers and mash and something like that. And I went down there. Previously to going down there, I had gone into the underground system just to say I had experienced being in the underground during a bombing. And I couldn't stand it. I don't know how the people down there could stand it.
Claustrophobic?
Claustrophobic, but the smell of humanity, because they weren't, for some reason or other, pumping much air through. And it was dank, and it just felt awful. I just couldn't stand it. I'd sooner be up top and bebop and take my chances rather than stay down there. And that's when I went down into the basement restaurant of the Lion's Corner House.
And it was open during the rain of summer.
Oh, yes. Stays open 24 hours a day. In the daytime, they open up the top floors. At nighttime, they close the top floors and just keep the basement open. And I guess it was a good bomb shelter as anywhere, except to stay there, you had to spend some money and eat or drink coffee all the time. And when it was time for me to catch my milk train from Victoria Station back to where we were staying at Limpsfield, I got out, and there was Whitehall stretching down ahead of me. And I decided to, this was about 5 o'clock in the morning, I decided to walk down the middle of Whitehall rather than up against the walls and on the inside of the sidewalk. And I had good old Home Guard fellows with helmets on shouting to me to get off the road and get in and so forth. Well, there was a bit of flak running around and the odd bomb.
It's the tail
end of the raid. And again, I didn't like to be near a building because if anything, if there was a delayed action bomb or something, the old wall would come out like that. It would just fall on top of you up against the wall. I had to get to the station to catch the milk train, otherwise I'd be listed as AWL. And this is before I was commissioned. And I just walked down the whole of length of Whitehall to Westminster, and then right down Westminster Street to Victoria Station. Caught my train, got back on time. But it was interesting. I was the only person. I felt kind of lonely at times. Mm. But it was about a three-quarters of an hour walk, I guess. Mm.
Did you feel comfortable in London? Did you like this city?
Oh, I love it. Love London.
You've been back since quite often?
Well, I was stationed at the War Office after the war, from 48 to 51. And I got to know some of the old parts. And, of course, I'd worked in London before I emigrated. And I just love London, the history of London. You know, up in the city of London there, they still have streets which are no wider than the length of your arms outstretched. And the pubs there are just as they were 400 years ago.
And
the cider they
give
you. Maybe it has,
yeah.
But I haven't visited London like that, really, since I left there in 51.
Well, actually, I was there last year, and it was very hard finding what my friend, when I went with a really good classical English pub. They're almost all walking red barrels now.
Maybe.
Yeah, which is sort of like McDonald's.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, there were nice little pubs down these alleys,
yeah,
that you couldn't have got a song and dance party in there because it wasn't big enough. You just went in, and you were checked over by the regulars. And you bought a drink, but they're backwards in coming forward and speaking to you.
And I suppose the fact that you had a flash on your shoulder saying Canada set you apart.
Well, but that used to sometimes help.
Didn't?
But when I said that, I was really thinking of the time when I was working in London before I emigrated. And some of the little pubs there, and if they gave you a draft cider, boy, you better not take more than one or you wouldn't walk out of there.
Yes, I know.
But I've always loved London. Always loved it, because if you know anything of the history of London, you just try and imagine yourself that there was wide open fields between the city of London and where Westminster is. And they used to go hunting through Kensington, fields of Kensington. The highwaymen were robbing people. Of course, they do that nowadays. But that was interesting.
Did you have anything else on your leaves?
No, most of my leaves were home, and I really didn't take that much leave, because we were kept pretty busy one way and another. The I remember rightly, what with daytime chores and things, and we used to have a fair amount of dances and so forth at night, and the life was pretty good, and we were having a pretty enjoyable time. There were some fellows who were homesick for Canada, but they gradually got better and better. Oh, I mean, they got over it,
mm-hmm.
because they were making friends with the English people.
And the camaraderie.
And, of course, the Canadians who were stationed around Aldershot, the families around Aldershot had been making friends with foreigners for centuries. And there was really no problem. The boys traveled a lot of distances in order to be with people outside of the area where their battalion was. What the people in the battalion don't know won't hurt them.
That was the general rule.
Which was a very, very good rule.
Yeah.
So the boys used to really scatter.
Mm. Which is probably good. It gives them a bit of a change.
Sure.
Now, for you personally, were you married in 1941 yet? Or?
I was married on the 31st of January 1942.
Okay. Did you go back to Canada, or did you want
no,
to come?
No, my wife, Lessa, was a secretary at the Vancouver General. And I wrote her a letter and said there would be a lady coming out, I didn't know her name, who would be looking for volunteers from Canadian girls to go over to England and, as volunteers, to drive military vehicles for ambulances, senior staff officers of the British War Office, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be one way for her to come over and for us we could then get married, because I had quite a few girlfriends in England at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I still wanted to marry this Canadian girl.
Mm-hmm.
And bless her, she, my letter arrived almost coincided with...
Okay, I think you were talking about your wife and she received a letter.
Oh, yes. My letter arrived almost coincident with notice in the Vancouver province that this lady was looking for volunteers. So my wife skipped from work and went and saw the lady and found that she had to pass a test driving a tractor-trailer vehicle,
mm-hmm.
which she'd never driven before in her life.